Westerners are terrible at playing the long game. Perhaps an unfortunate byproduct of our modern democratic republics, the West at large can't see past the next election, the next decade. The farthest most can see is morbidity of the grave, thinking if my world ends there, so it must for everyone else. But if the West is to be saved, our minds must be stretched to see beyond our own lifetimes, like the enemies of the West do every day in preparation in the shadow of Western hegemony. We may not save ourselves, but we can save our children. In fact, all of our hope rests in them. But first, we must get to having children at all. If we view the past, our traditions, religion, morality, sense of beauty, as something handed down to us, we inevitably recognize a duty to pass on this inheritance. And if we don't pass on these cornerstones of Western civilization to the next generation, they and the West inevitably die with us.
I really like that. That's from a guy who calls himself Thinking West. That's his little program, his moniker. And today we're going to be talking about Western civilization. Do you know what that is? Do you know what that is? Could you define it if someone asked you to right now? And even though you might understand in general why it's under attack, do you know why it's under attack? Do you know why we can't defend it? Do you know why we can't define it? In addition to maybe not knowing what it actually is, well, today's discussion is so interesting. There's a new book called The Golden Thread, A History of the Western Tradition. And today I'm talking with a professor from Harvard. He just left Harvard, actually. He's been teaching for 40 years. Just a great guy. His name is Professor James Hankins. And we're going to be talking about what's happened. What is Western civilization? Why are we so weak in defending it? Why do we not even know what it is? And why should we know what it is in order to defend it? And so I think you're going to enjoy it. But first, this is Sandy Rios on Sandy Rios 24/7. Call us, please, at 662-821-2040 and leave a message so that we can hear your voices. It's great to know who's listening. 662-821-2040. It's also great to hear what you're thinking. Also, you can go to sandy@afr.net if you'd rather, you know, send an email kind of telling me what's on your mind. Sandy@afr.net. You can find us on social media platforms. And also, you can listen to the podcast on any podcast platform, including sandyrios.com, which is my website. It's easy. If you're not a podcaster or you're not used to it, that's very, very simple, sandyrios.com. If not, and in addition, those of you that are American Family Radio listeners and have been for years, because I was on the show on the radio with AFA every morning for 10 years in the morning show. So go to afr.net and that will, you know, give you a really good way. You just have to look for podcasts and you'll find Sandy Rios 24/7. Well, it's the Christmas season. And when Mary said, let it, she gives this beautiful, beautiful response when the angel Gabriel tells her she's going to have a baby, even though she's a virgin. It's amazing, honestly, the depth. She says, let it be done to me according to your word. Lord, I know I'm only a kid, and I've never known a man. I don't even know quite what that means. And yet you're going to make me pregnant with a child. I'm going to be facing the disgrace. I've got to explain it to my fiancé, Joseph. But Lord, let it be done to me according to your word. What kind of faith does a girl have to say that? I would say great faith and depth. And when you read that whole Song of Mary, you understand maybe why God chose her to be the mother of his son. It's pretty amazing. Well, today, countless mothers face the same moment of decision when they see their baby on ultrasound, whether to keep it or let it go. They're scared, they're unsure, and their moment to say yes could pass, but you can make a difference right now. Because of the generosity of so many of you who listen and give just generously to preborn clinics, you can save a baby, and you can also save the mom in a different way. Maybe not her life. Chances are not her life, but her eternal life, her eternity, the part of her that'll never die is still to be determined. And it makes a difference how we live our lives and what choices we make. And apart from that, even if she is a believer in Christ, however maybe disobedient she would be to choose an abortion, it's the abundant life that she'll be missing. There's a lot of stake. It's the life of the baby, and it's really the life in a different way of the mother. And so if you'd like to help support preborn, and so many of you have, and I'm so grateful. I truly am. And of course, we could not do this show if we didn't have their support. But if you want to give a really good Christmas gift, go to preborn.com/Sandy. That's preborn.com/Sandy and make your most generous donation. Well, it's called The Golden Thread, A History of Western Tradition. It is a great story, and we're going to have the professor, Professor James Hankins, tell you that story on this edition of Sandy Rios 24/7.
From American Family Radio, Sandy Rios.
We are not called to be nice. We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
I think the most important thing we need to demonstrate to our children is genuineness, that we actually believe what we say we believe.
A longtime Fox News contributor, Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
Seek justice. Not social justice, but God's justice. What's right and what's wrong.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association.
A pro-life radio talk show host.
We've got to say this is the line. Life is sacred.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up. Speak up. Say something. Do something.
What is driving Western civilization to be so suicidal? Why is it the only civilization on earth that is determined to tear itself down, to cast phony blame on itself for being the source of all the world's evils? Chinese civilization is not doing that. Indian civilization, African cultures are not doing that. Why us? And why this corrosive questioning of authority all the time and our own accomplishments?
All right, that's a little clip, a great question from a program called Socrates in the City. And actually, we're going to be talking today about our history. I'm talking about the long train of our history, 3,000 years of Western civilization. And I'll just read this introduction. I think this says it best. The Golden Thread, A History of the Western Tradition, is written by Alan Guelzo and James Hankins, esteemed historians at Princeton University and Harvard University, respectively, offer an extraordinary and ambitious two-volume history that redefines how students and the general public encounter the Western tradition. The Golden Thread presents an eloquent and refreshing overview of the trajectory of the West, its unique customs of art and literature, law, philosophy, science, faith, and tolerance that have bound the people of its tradition together, from the ancient Greeks and Romans to medieval Christendom and Europe, and finally, the modern world and America. And so, I have one half of the authorship here, and his name is Dr. Jim Professor Hankins. He is the Harvard professor who's been there for 40 years. His history, his own resume is pretty impressive. And actually, I'll go to that in just a second, but I just want to say good morning first. Professor, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me on. It's a pleasure.
You know, I want to, the Golden Thread, what a great name. And what, can you kind of give us an idea before we get into the content, what that meant to you?
Well, it's a reference to the myth of Theseus and the Minotaur and the thread that gets Theseus out of the Minotaur. It's an ancient Greek story, but it's about freeing youths from the power of technology, the power of perversion. So I thought it was a great title because it does offer a way to get out of the disastrous times that we live in.
Yeah.
And I think the way to get out is by retracing our steps and going back to the ancient Greeks and Romans and medieval Christendom and to European civilization and understand where we came from.
You know, you don't know, but I'll tell you that I'm a history lover, of course, a layperson, and there's such huge gaps in my knowledge, but I'm so eager to hear. You cover from what? What's the period of time? It's the Greeks and the Romans, but it's 3,000 years A.D.?
Well, we start about 1,000 B.C.
Okay.
And that's where the Greek civilization takes place. It's not the beginning of civilization as such, because that goes back another 3,000 years to the Egyptians and the Babylonians and so forth. So we start with the West because we're tracing a tradition. And the tradition is based in language, Greek, Latin, and successor languages to that, which include French and Italian modern languages. But that's not the point. The point is that we're trying to give people access to their own tradition again, which has been lost in the last 40 years. And yeah, it's a terrible tragedy.
I agree.
About 40 years ago, the progressive education establishment decided that it was going to give up Western Civ. It used to be required, and now it's been replaced by a kind of global history. So if you go back, 40 years and look at social studies requirements for all the 50 states, they used to often require Western Civ in the high schools, and many colleges also required it. But somehow, from basically the mid-80s to 2010, all of these Western Civ requirements were wiped out. And we were left with global civilization, which, of course, is not a civilization. There's no such thing as global civilization. But that's what students study in high school and colleges today. They don't have any sense of their own tradition.
Totally.
And, guess what? When people don't study their own tradition, they don't have any conception of what they're defending, and bad actors step in and tell us that our civilization is evil, white supremacists, slave owners, all this kind of stuff. And if you have your heads completely empty, if you have no history of your own that you can fall back on, no education in that subject, you say, oh, that must be true. Somebody said that in a university. So,
it's the truth.
So this is why Alan and I, my buddy Alan Gelzo and I, have been trying to, and along with, help, obviously, from Encounter Books and its wonderful staff there, we have been trying to revive the study of Western civilizations.
Oh, I love that.
Alan and I have both left our perches at Harvard and Princeton, and we're going down to the Hamilton School for Classical and Civic Education. And the main purpose in going there is to restart the study of Western Civ. And we strongly believe that this is the way to, reorient our country at this time, because, one reason why people are so have no idea what direction to go in is because they have no idea where they've been.
That's absolutely true. The Hamilton School of Classical and Civic Education is at the University of Florida. Is this a new division? This sounds like it's a new endeavor. I mean, I think it's great that you guys are coming. Yeah. I live in Florida, so I'm happy about this. But is this a new endeavor from University of Florida?
Well, it's really coming from the governor. Hamilton School was founded about 5 years ago. I've been on the board there since the founding, but I'm actually going to go there now, putting my money where my mouth is, and we're going to, next summer, I'm going to join the faculty there.
Oh, that's
so
great.
The idea is to revive classical studies. I'm sure you're aware of the classical education movement, and also to revive civic studies. You're probably aware that there are a number of red states in particular, but not only red states, that are trying to revive the study of civics, which means people learning about their own country, about our political system, about the values that inform our civilization, our country, and trying to make sure that we produce good citizens who are informed and able to reason.
I think I've been on that mission myself on radio. I've been on radio since the mid-90s in Chicago, way back. Civics and education and history, these are the resounding themes. So you're making my heart beat fast. I'll tell you, I started my love of history. I'm old enough that I had really good teaching. I didn't like it. I had very boring history teachers. I'll never forget, when I was 16, was terrible. It was just terrible. I read a poem during the class. He was so boring. But I fell in love with history in junior high because I had a teacher, Mr. Bowen, who taught the Civil War, and he taught it with such detail and animation and passion that I was like on the edge of my seat every day. And that's really what birthed my love of history. So I want to ask you, I know we have a lot to speak about, but what? How about you? How did you fall in love with history?
Oh, you know, I think I fell in love with history despite bad teaching. but I had some really good history teachers and literature teachers who also got me interested in history. That's the way it's passed down. People love it, people who know it. You know, it's not just a subject where you're reading from, you know, a prep prepared by other people, but people who are really devoted to the subject. And, you know, we historians are a little bit slightly crazy. My mother used to say, you know, get your head out of a book, stop reading. And I was just fascinated by history from a very early age. And and my buddy Alan Gelso was also, we were actually in middle school together. We met on the middle school spelling bee when we were both very young. And we have kept in contact over the years, and we had thought about having a Western Civ book because we're both aware that the incredible ignorance of people today about history is just so disruptive. Encounter Books came along and asked us to write
this
book. We were both all in from the beginning, but our friendship goes way, way back. And that's why we're able to do this book together, because we agree about so many things.
All right. Well, before we can talk too much, because we've lost so much of our knowledge, and that goes for the parents listening, sometimes the grandparents listening, it goes back so far that people don't really even. I'll just give you an example. I won't mention who, but a close family member was moving to another country and lived there for a while and then asked me, great education this person has in college and undergrad, everything. She said, I don't really know what it means to be an American. And I know that's limiting. It's broader than that. But she actually didn't know as a young woman what it meant to be an American or what was unique. So I think we've lost our understanding of Western civilization and certainly the magic and beauty of it. So I think we have to start there. So, Professor, what is Western civilization?
Well, you can't understand the uniqueness of America without understanding Western civilization. Western civilization is actually, I would use the plural there, civilizations, because we start with the Greeks, and then we have the Romans, and then we have the Christianization of the Roman Empire in the 4th century AD. Then we have a period of confessional states where the official religion is Christianity, and that goes down really to the 18th century. And we have Christendom, the period when Christianity dominates the culture of the Western world. And then we have the modern period. So I would count all of that as part of the Western tradition. But they're like Russian dolls. They live, Greek is picking up by the Romans, and the Romans are Christianized by the Christians who don't want to get rid of the Roman achievement. And then later, the Germanic countries, like in time of Charlemagne, they decide they need to be Roman and Greek. And then you have another revival. So we have the Western Civ. The most encouraging thing about Western Civ is that we constantly have revivals and renaissances and reforms. It's just the nature of our civilization, much more so, I think, than other civilizations like the Chinese civilization. So we're always in danger of losing the thread that connects us to the past. But there have always been people in every generation who said, no, that is too valuable to throw overboard. You know, the Greeks' idea of democracy, of citizenship, of people should rule themselves, that people can rule themselves, that people can use reason and persuasion to make policy and not just, you know, have a monarch tell them what to do, that we can use reason to advance all sorts of sciences and arts, that we can take the medicine of, this is the Greek belief, right? They were surrounded by older civilizations that had medical treatments, but they didn't have medical science. And the Greeks invented medical science. They were surrounded by civilizations that had an ability to calculate, and maybe they could tell about eclipses that were coming, and they had multiplication, division. But what they didn't have was mathematical argument. which was invented by the Greeks, the idea that you can go, the idea behind Euclidean geometry, right, that you can make mathematics into a real science. So the Greeks, you know, we owe a tremendous amount to the Greeks. All of our literary genres come from them, tragedy, comedy, epic, lyric poetry, you name it. They invented history in its classic Western form. There's just so much we owe to the Greeks that if you don't study that, you don't realize the importance of it. People just take all these things for granted, right? The rule of law. So, yeah, we have the rule of law. They don't know what it is. But the Romans invented it. And the idea of the rule of law basically is that law is above politics. And law is rooted in the law of nature, which is God's law, right? So this is something that's tremendously important in the Western tradition. People use the phrase, I hear this all the time, you know, we in the West believe in democracy and we believe in rule of law, and we believe in liberty and so forth, but it's a very shallow understanding. And that's where you get things like the current debate about democracy. You know, everybody thinks they're defending democracy. The Democrats mm-hmm. think they're defending democracy, you know, and the Republicans do, and probably there are monarchists somewhere who think that they're defending democracy. But you really can't use the word in any, we have to agree about what that word means. We have to agree about what republics mean.
So what would you, let's pause just for a second. And I know this could be a whole conversation. But define democracy, please, for our poor country who doesn't seem to understand it.
Well, the ancient Greeks defined it as the ability to rule yourself. This is a great 5th century BC defender of democracy. There's a man named Protagoras, and he says, man is the measure of all things and equally gifted by the gods. That part's always left out. And gifted by the gods with a knowledge of justice and an experience of shame, right? So the great argument was that people can rule themselves. That you, if you participated in government, if you sat on juries, and Athenian juries can be very, very large, like 2,000 people. You sat on juries. If you participated in the assemblies, if you worked on the councils to prepare business for the assemblies, you would acquire the ability to rule yourself. And you didn't have to have experts. You didn't have to have, you know, people like Plato who told you that you can only be ruled well by experts and by people who had absolutely true and secure knowledge. People can rule themselves. That's the great message of the Greeks. And it has huge consequences for the history of the West, because if you rule yourself, it means you don't take orders, right? In a monarchy, the monarch takes counsel, and then he gives orders. In the democracy, people get up in an assembly or a council and say, we should do this. And then they have to persuade people that we should do this. So you have, and what comes out of that is the art of persuasion, of course, but it also has to be the art of reasoning. Because ultimately, if you argue long enough, you're going to have to produce reasons and evidence. And that's really been a part of the Western tradition from the very beginning, that you argue for policies, you argue for what we should do to make choices based on reason, based on your loyalties also, because in the Greeks strongly believed that they should be loyal to the gods or to the divine in some form. And that has also been passed down from the Greeks to the Romans to Christian civilization, that we have to have love and respect for the divine things.
I have so many questions. So let me interject for a minute. You know, most of my understanding, I did study Latin, and I'm not without knowledge. I probably have less knowledge about the Greeks. I have some, but not enough. And so I always think that the reason that men can self-govern is because they do believe in a higher power. For me, it's God. But the Greeks, I know they had a lot of gods. So what What is the root of their devotion to, I mean, how do you come around an idea like that with unity if you don't have one God? I'm just curious. I mean, that's a hard question, I guess.
Well, you know, the Greeks, whenever they started talking about the gods and telling their myths, that there were always people who were kind of disgusted at the popular beliefs, and they wanted to have a more exalted conception of the divine. A divine is something that's permanent, eternal, and a source of good, and a source of divine concern for the behavior of human beings. So the philosophers turned this into a very abstract belief about divinity, right? Common people had a lot of noxious ideas, and someone like Socrates, that was really the basis of his teaching, the reason why he was executed by the Athenians, because he said we need to have a higher conception of the divine. And so that ultimately links up with Christianity, because Christians, when they first began to deepen their understanding of the apostolic age, they turned to philosophers. You have many Christian Platonists. You have many Christians who, like St. Paul, who was had an education in Stoicism. And you see Stoic concepts. He's not a Stoic. I'm not meaning to suggest that. But they use philosophy to understand religion and to also to communicate with the people around them who might understand philosophy but not understand Christianity. So, you know, Paul and Augustine and all the early Christian fathers, church fathers, all tried very hard to use philosophical concepts to show the superiority of Christianity and how it basically solved problems of philosophy that the Greek philosophers had not been able to solve on their own. This is how the Greeks, I think, contribute to the world of modern theism. The Greeks ended up being monotheistic in their paganism, right? That they decided that the pagan gods were just, you know, effects of the one true God, but they disagreed with Christians about who that was. That was what it came down to in late antiquity.
Oh, yeah, of course, I'm sure we think of the passage in Romans where Paul speaks to the Greeks in Athens and says, "Ye men of Athens, I perceive you're very religious, and you have all these gods, but it's the unknown God. That's the one I want to talk to you about." And he did use their reasoning. He used their methods of reasoning to reason with them. Okay, I'm unclear about. I certainly know that the Greeks were conquered by the Romans and that they became sort of slaves in the sense of the old world, but that. The Romans, correct me if I'm wrong, always really revered Greek scholarship, and they would, like a lot of the slaves were Greek men who would teach their children. Okay, so that's a simplistic way of saying it. But how did that transition work, and how was Rome, how did they morph those ideas into their own style?
Well, this is the great thing about the Western tradition that, you know, many empires, when they conquer another country, they just destroy it, and they destroy, they enslave the people, and they destroy the culture. They have, you know, culture. The Romans, and none of the Western civilizations ever did that. The Romans really admired the Greeks. When they conquered them in the 2nd century B.C., there were Romans leaders of the Senate who said, "We cannot afford to lose Greek culture. We need to have our own Roman version of Greek culture." They understood that the Greeks of the classical age and the philosophers were immensely valuable. So the Romans started to imitate the Greeks. They always there was a kind of union between Greek and Roman culture starting in the 2nd century B.C. And ultimately, by the time of Augustus, the Romans were producing works of literature and philosophy that were the equals of what the Greeks had done. And then when the Christians come along in the 4th century and take over the Roman Empire, they also say, we can't lose this heritage. We need it just to understand the Bible, right? That the Bible is written in Hebrew and Greek, so we have to know Hebrew and Greek. We have to understand history if we're going to understand the Bible. There's all sorts of things we need. Taken culture into a formation in ancient sciences and arts that will help us to understand the Bible. That's what Augustine was always saying. That was his justification for studying pagan culture. But that was continued throughout the Middle Ages. And when the Germanic barbarians conquered the Western Roman Empire, they were very proud of their own tribal traditions. But ultimately, when they wanted to set up a real kingdom, they discovered that they needed Rome because they didn't have anything like civilization. They didn't have, the Goths who conquered Western Europe in the 5th century, they didn't have very much in their own language. They had the Bible. They had a Gothic Bible, a few other texts. But if they really wanted access to the literature of the past, and particularly to the law and the administrative understandings of the Romans, they had to go back. They had to go back and learn Latin, make sure they knew Latin. And so, when the barbarian kingdoms ultimately are mature, they draw on Rome. And the ultimate example of that is Charlemagne, who is a Frankish barbarian, but he says, no, we have to go back to the Romans. We have to revive not only Roman law, which had been lost, but also all of the culture of Rome. So that's where we get, actually, most of the other books that survive from in Latin come to us because of Charlemagne.
We're having a great discussion. I'm going to interrupt it for a second with Dr. James Hankins, who is a historian from Harvard. He was teaching there for 40 years. He's now coming down to Florida to teach at the University of Florida in their Hamilton School at the behest of Governor DeSantis. Isn't that something? This is news to me. It's a great discussion. I am loving it, and we're going to get back to it in just a second. But first, it's Christmas, and there are babies in their mother's wombs who need our help right now. As the year comes to a close, your tax-deductible donation can be the difference between life and death. Would you consider a leadership gift to save babies in a bigger way? Your gift of $5,000, $10,000, or $15,000 will be used to save countless babies for years to come. If you can do one of those big gifts, if you can't, it's $28 for one ultrasound. You do what you can. You know, do what God lays on your heart to do. But go to preborn.com/Sandy. Preborn.com/Sandy and make your most generous donation.
This is Sandy Rios 24/7 on American Family Radio.
And now back to our discussion with Dr. James Hankins, the author of The Golden Thread, A History of the Western Tradition.
Actually, most of the other books that survived from in Latin come to us because of Charlemagne. Decided we needed that. It's an amazing thing that most people don't realize how incredibly fragile Western civilization has been. And I think it's also currently very fragile. But we've always recovered. There have always been some people who have understood the value of things. But we've almost lost the Roman jurisprudence, who was down to one manuscript in the 11th century. There was only one manuscript which contained all of the, called the Digest. It was part of the corpus of Roman law. And it kind of shocks me and stuns me that we almost lost this text, which became later on the basis of legal education in the West from the 12th century.
Wow.
In some ways, down to the present, we still use Roman jurisprudence. The Roman experience of how to settle cases, so that's fair that people accept it. It's based in reason. It's based in law. All of that Roman experience was captured in this one book, The Digest, and we almost lost it. It's just, it's kind of scary when you think about it.
Well, of course, you would have more information than I. But how many times, as we are saying, Western civilization is fragile, maybe because the very fact that it teaches men to think freely and to make their own decisions and to rule themselves, and it makes it unruly, a little unwieldy. But I want to ask you a practical question. The Greeks, I don't know anything about this part of their of them. I know they were, the thinking was amazing, the Senate, the law, all that you're talking about. But the Romans seem to, this is my perspective, so correct me. The Romans seem to practically apply that stuff. They became, as you said, they developed civilization, roads and aqueducts and language, and everything spread like lightning, these thoughts and ideas, because of the things that they were able to establish, and a language that became the basis, as you alluded to earlier, for all the languages that the Western civilization speaks now, like, you know, English and French and Italian and all the others. So it's the basis. It's just the basis. It's just amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm sorry. I'm being a professor and adding more information.
No. I want you to. I'm being a talk show host, and I'm adding too much too.
Okay. Well, let me just. The Romans were very self-conscious about what they were good at, what they were bad at. So they thought the most important thing was law and military power and government. And they said to the Greeks that we're better at this than you. We know how to rule provinces. We know how to win wars. We know how to defend our civilization against outsiders or invaders. But the Greeks, you guys are great at philosophy and the arts and a few other things and speaking well. So we're going to protect that heritage. But the Romans, you know, I don't really accept the picture of them as kind of passively absorbing what the Greeks do. They always develop it. And I think that, personally, this is my personal taste, I think Virgil's Aeneid is much better than Homer. Very few people will agree with me on that, but I really love Virgil. I think it's a marvelous work of epic literature. But if you look at architecture, this is much more evident, right? If you look at architecture, the Greek architecture is beautiful, but it's very limited technically. And the Roman, you know, they used the arch, and they used concrete, and they had much superior engineering skill than the Greeks ever had. And that's why we still have these beautiful arches everywhere, that from the aqueducts, so you can go to Europe, you see the aqueducts everywhere built by the Romans. The Romans were the first civilization to understand the importance of water. So every city had to have clean water. And they built these enormous buildings, and they built the dome, which the Greeks never really got to. And they were able to, you know, I study a little bit Roman architecture, and I think they just leave the Greeks in the dust that they have such wonderful buildings. So, you know, I'm not sure I accept the view of the Romans as inferior to the Greeks. They're certainly inferior in the realms of philosophy and the arts. And,
okay. Well, that's interesting.
But they have great contributions.
Okay, so the Romans are the dominant force of Western civilization for several hundred years. And then, as you said, the hordes come in. Rome crumbles, and the hordes come, the Germanic hordes. And so what happens next? I know there's so much more to history, but how do you make that link now to, whatever link you want to make, Professor? You know how to do that better than I. You're teaching an hour course here. So what happens next that's significant?
Okay, well, a key thing to remember is that the Roman Empire only fell in the West, in the Latin-speaking part of the empire. But in the East, Eastern Mediterranean, which includes all of Asia Minor and Syria, Palestine, Egypt, which are all Greek-speaking areas, it goes on. And the Greek-Roman Empire is attacked in the 7th century by the Muslims, the Arabic armies, which take away two-thirds of the Roman Empire, but they still remain there until 1453, when Constantinople is finally conquered by the Muslims. But so the main defenders of Western civilization from the fall of the Roman Empire to the time of Charlemagne, which is about 300 years, is the Greek East. And they go on and on and on. They preserve the Greek tradition until the very end, when The Greeks are about to collapse, and they have a bunch of Greeks who come to Italy and decide that, you know, Italy is the place they have to transplant their culture. So we have this really remarkable thing that happens in the 15th century. In the West, their main learned language, the language of diplomacy and religion and high intellectual activity, is Latin. And then the Latins decide that they have to create Greek culture, recreate Greek culture in the West. And that's when people start learning Greek in school as well as Latin. So it's a very remarkable thing that we lost the Greek Empire, but we saved the Greek culture in the West.
But that is
after the the Western Empire fell, it was already Christianized, and the barbarians were Christianized. So when they conquered the West, Christianity was the thing that they had in common with between the barbarians and Rome. So when Rome was sacked in 410 A.D. by the barbarians, historian Peter Heather describes that as the most civilized sack in history, because they didn't destroy that much. They were fellow Christians. And this is a great story in Jerome, where one of the barbarian soldiers invades a convent, and he wants to rape a young woman who's in the convent. And the mother superior points to him and says, Jesus would not like that. You know, Jesus, this is not allowed in Christianity. And since he's some kind of Christian, Aryan Christian, he says, oh, and she faces him down and sends him on his way. So, you know, in any barbarian invasion by the Huns, you could be sure all those nuns would have no happy outcome to the story, because the Huns were never Christian, but the Goths were, and that made a huge difference.
That's really interesting. Mm-hmm. Well, okay, so you've alluded to this, but you haven't really said, and I want to know what you think. Because the Greeks were not... You know, they didn't believe in the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, which is the God of Christians, and they believed in gods plural. And then the Romans, pluralistic, and then they were Christianized. So then, from there on, Western civilization is it not true? Would you not say, because I can't think of an exception, that it did become, even though, of course, you and I both know, not really Christian, but Christian in the broadest sense of the definition. And up until this time?
Well, the Romans were pagans, and they were relatively tolerant of other religions, except Christianity. The Romans were not tolerant of Christianity because it worshipped a criminal executed by the Roman state. And they were an underground movement. They were illegal. So when they take over the Roman Empire by a kind of the miraculous conversion of Constantine, which is not quite a miracle, but I explain why that happens in the book. So when they take over the Roman Empire, they are determined to Christianize it. And I don't think that it's true that the late, we call this late antiquity, the period from the Christian conquest of Rome to the Islamic conquest of Rome, that period of three centuries, the Christians were very determined to Christianize Rome. They were not completely intolerant. They tolerated Jews, for example. Jews were not allowed to publicly practice the religion, but they were allowed to do it in private. And pagans were not allowed to publicly practice their religion. They couldn't, you know, have the temples open and make sacrifices. All that was prohibited. But they were not really persecuted at any time except for, well, very brief persecutions. So there was a certain degree of tolerance in the Roman Empire, but it was very clear that we are now a Christian empire. It's stated explicitly in all the legal documents, and we are going to defend the Christianity. And if you think of, you know, the position of any ruler, if a ruler is Christian, he thinks that the eternal fate of any Christian is the most important thing. Are they going to go to heaven? Are they going to go to hell? So if you're a responsible Christian ruler, you're going to want your citizens to be Christian. You're going to do everything you can, short of forcing them at sword point to be baptized. They didn't do that. If you're a Christian ruler, you want your citizens to be Christian. It's the worst thing you can do is allow them to stray from the path of Jesus, right? So... They had Christian education. They had Christian institutions. They reformed the laws of Rome. So, you know, before the time of Theodosius, who is the one who finally makes Rome Christian, masters, if they had a female slave, they could rape the slave, and nothing anyone could do about it. It was perfectly acceptable. And to Romans of the old type, they might frown on it if there was violence, but there's a lot of abuse of women in the Roman Empire, and the Theodosian Code specifies that anybody who does this is to be punished severely by death, right? So and there's a defense of the dignity of women, that women have a right to decide these things for themselves, and you find that. You know, it's a remarkable thing. It's a great example of how Christianity tries to change Rome and does change Rome.
Yes, absolutely. And then Rome changes the world. And then most of the countries that come out of that become Christian of a sort, but then it becomes very corrupt. And then there's a Reformation, which shakes up the whole world of Christendom. And let me ask you about one. I don't want us to not talk about this. In your book, as I understand it, you have a collection of artwork and I think architecture, maybe you can tell me, that the stuff that came out of Western civilization that really I don't think there's anything like it out of any other culture. Can you just say something about that, the effect on art and music and all of that?
Sure. I only take partial credit for the writing, but the book itself is, I think, the most beautiful piece of bookmaking I've seen in many, many years. It's huge. It's 7 pounds.
And wow.
1,250 pages. But wow. A lot of that, I would say almost a half of that is illustrations, maps, timelines, things like that. But one thing that I really love about this book is they had full-time staff working on illustrating it in consultation with Alan and I. And they just have it's beautiful illustrations, and they're extremely apropos, right? That they're closely related to the things we're talking about in the text, which is not always the case with illustrations. So it's we tried to teach also, in addition to a basic narrative storyline about political and intellectual religious history. That's the basic storyline. But we have also long treatments of Greek culture, theater, comedy, painting, architecture, sculpture. And we have discussions of philosophy and science and literature. So, you know, we're trying to give we call it the history of the Western tradition rather than Western civilization, because we're emphasizing all of the beautiful and brilliant and wonderful things that were passed down from the Greeks and the Romans and medieval Christians. There's a long section, which I'm particularly proud of, on Gothic architecture, and how that whole tradition of architecture got started in the 12th and 13th centuries. So I think that people will, the idea we had is that people would have some kind of framework on which to hang their further studies of the arts and literature and philosophy and music and so forth, so that people would be able to place things. I think that's very important. You learn much better if you have a fundamental narrative framework for what happens. So Greek philosophy and political philosophy is a response to the collapse of Greek policies in the late 5th century, and the Gothic architecture is a response to the church's desire to teach lay people as well as religious people. They use the cathedrals as teaching tools. That's what the stained glass windows are. Is telling the stories of Christ to populate in this very beautiful way.
Hey, let me ask you, I have a very strong bias, of course I do, but I've traveled a lot. I've been overseas a lot to some great other civilizations. Not that I know all about them, but my question is this, it just seems that Western civilization has produced architecture and music and paintings and art. We're not doing that now. I think this is what I see, a degradation of all of that now. Stupid, dumb, mindless, embarrassing things we're creating now. There may be some exceptions, but I don't know of another culture that's had that kind of output of beauty. Do you Do you have an opinion about that?
Well, it's not quite a fair comparison because we consider the Western tradition to be four civilizations. So if you compare four civilizations with China, I think you'd have to say that the four civilizations of the West are much richer than Chinese. But Chinese civilization is very rich. I spent a lot of time in China because I am involved with Confucian academies there. And they have historical writing. They have their own architectural forms, which have a long history. They have tons of literature and arts and so forth. But if you put all the four civilizations of the West together, there's no question in my mind that the whole tradition is much richer than Chinese civilization.
Oh, I totally agree. I was just going to say that I've been in China several times too, and I think it is beautiful. The things they've created, and also like the first century of China, the Qing dynasty. What I think it's the Qing dynasty with the costuming and all that. But maybe it's my Western ears. Certainly with music, I think that's limited. It doesn't have the rich variety, and the music certainly because of the. In fact, they've adopted Western music. You know, they don't have. They have some of the original first century music as best they can recreate it, but. They don't have that. They have taken Western music and carried on with that. I think that's interesting. And the West hasn't really done that. Well,
yeah,
we start.
That's true. The Western music just, it has really triumphed in East Asia. It's so much so that they're not aware of it, right? They think it happened several generations ago. My wife is from Thailand. She listens to Thai music all the time, and I keep telling her that's Western music. It's not Thai music. But she doesn't like that, but it's true.
Can I tell you a funny story? This is not very lofty, but I was in Bangkok, and I was staying in one of the most gorgeous hotels I've ever seen in my life. I was with a small group of people. We were journalists and talk show people. And so we had a guide named Chuchart, who was just delightful, but he didn't speak very good English. He wasn't a great translator. And we were at this beautiful, incredible buffet, which I'm sure you've seen in Thailand, and they just have food everywhere and all over the room. And and these girls are sitting cross-legged with the Thai instrument, whatever it's called, and in their native dress, and they're, I'm sorry, I'm imitating, it's terrible. But it was beautiful, beautiful at first. But I, the more I stood there waiting in line, the more like, it was just grating at my ears because they have a totally different tone scale and all of that. And Chuchart, our guide, leaned into my ear and said, "Oh, I just love that song."
Yeah, I had a similar experience in the Peking Opera in Beijing. So I was taken by a Chinese friend, and it just was, from my point of view, it was so loud and so atonal. It wasn't atonal, but I didn't understand the tonality. And it was just painful to sit there. And I'm saying to myself, is everyone enjoying this? You know, I'm looking around at the Chinese audience, and they're all smiling and, looking very pleased and happy. And I say to myself, this is really, if I were brought up to understand this music, I could maybe enjoy it, but I haven't been. And this is my worry with Western civilization, too, that, we have this tremendous musical tradition, and you have to be brought up in it to a certain point. I'm very grateful that in my high school, we had wonderful musical programs. We sang and we played lots of classical music. And we learned about that tradition that way. But I'm worried that, the next generation won't be able to hear Bach. They'll be as Mozart or Beethoven. They'll be as mystified by that music as I was by the Peking Opera, which is why we have to teach traditions.
Totally. And, and of course, now it's racist to like that stuff, so... But I we started out the show, Professor Hankins, with a question from that Socrates in the West, and the woman asked, why is Western civilization bent on destroying itself? Why does it hate itself so much? And I'd love to quickly, if that's possible, get your answer to that and what you think the remedy might be.
Well, the interests are a line for that. The generations decided to throw away or become hostile to America and the West is the Vietnam generation of professors who did this in the 80s and 90s. They decided that Western civilization was colonialist and sexist and racist and all that, and they didn't want to teach it anymore. So, and when you don't teach something, you get bad actors step in and say, well, don't you know that your civilization is racist and sexist and, you know, slave owning and all these kind of things? And if you don't know anything, you might not understand that pretty much all civilizations have some form of unfree labor and that the Islamic civilization is much worse in terms of slavery than the modern West is, and the modern West is self-critical and will. So you end up with other bad actors telling people what to think, and if there's nothing between their ears, they never studied things, they will accept it. So I think the Vietnam generations had a very bad influence on American education, but they were helped by globalists, people who wanted to globalize the economy and get the cheapest labor in other places and hollow out American industry. And those people also welcomed globalization, which we've been doing globalization at Harvard since the 1980s. So if you look on, I think I saw this in the U.S. News and World Report rankings. They have a ranking for international universities, and Harvard's at the top of that. If you look at, I think, the City Journal, which rates places on the basis of their loyalty to the Western tradition and to the teaching of American history, my new university, University of Florida, comes out on top, and Harvard comes out, you know, 37, 38, something like that. So we have to change our view of what a good university is, for one thing. But also, the way to get out of this negative spiral that we're in is to teach our own tradition. And I think we also have to use that to assimilate people, because one of the biggest problems we have today in America is unassimilated populations. I guess you've been following what's going on in Minnesota. That's just horrifying.
I know.
And when Dami elected as mayor, these Islamists who are all over the United States took this as a sign that, you know, Islam is going to conquer and they're going to take over the United States. They've become very obstreperous all over the country and committing violent acts. Not all Islamic peoples, of course, but I think that we have to use Western civ and American history to help assimilate these populations that are coming in and have a really hostile attitude in many cases towards the American culture. They want to use its benefits. They want to get all the free stuff they can, but they don't want to assimilate. They don't want to become part of the country in the way older generations did.
Right, and Americans, I think, are waking up to that. But we, again, because of what we started out saying, most Americans don't really understand what a treasure we have. And so I think it's a perfect time for your book, just perfect. The Golden Thread, A History of the Western Tradition. And the co-author is Dr. James Hankins. He wrote it with Dr. Alan Guelzo. What a great story you guys have. Professor Hankins from Harvard and Dr. Guelzo from Princeton, long-term friends, long-term historians. That in itself is a great story. Dr. Hankins, and it's been a privilege. Thank you so much for joining me. And I'm a Floridian, so I'm going to welcome you down to Florida ahead of time. So we're going to love having you here.
Okay, well, I'll be there already in January. I'm looking forward to it. And thank you for having me on. It was really great to talk to you.
My great pleasure. Well, all right. Well, thank you. And this is Sandy Rios on Sandy Rios 24/7.
The Sandy Rios 24/7 podcast are available at AFR.net. Back to Sandy Rios 24/7 on American Family Radio.
Western civilization. It's been around for a while, but suddenly everybody is talking about it. Some are anxious to save it. Others are happy to see it go. But what exactly is Western civilization? Is it the great cathedrals of Europe or the Nazi concentration camps? Is it the freedoms secured in the U.S. Constitution or chattel slavery? life-saving medicines, or poison gas. The left likes to focus on the bad: genocide, slavery, environmental destruction. But those have been present in every civilization from time immemorial. The positives are unique to the West: religious tolerance, abolition of slavery, universal human rights, the development of the scientific method. These are accomplishments of a scope and scale that only the West can claim.
That's Ben Shapiro with Prager University. Prager U makes these great short videos, 5 minutes, to explain the deep topics of life. And that's part of their short offering on Western civilization. You know, the thing that Western civilization, besides being an avenue to spread the gospel, which I didn't talk to the professor about, although I think he would have agreed, but Western civilization has created human flourishing, unleashed creativity, unleashed capitalism in all the best sense of the word, investment and gains and progress and ideas and great art and great music and great everything, just unleashing the beauty of the mind that God has given individual people working together. It doesn't happen in other cultures. It's one of the reasons our founding fathers came here, because patents, their ideas, the things that they wanted to make that they thought didn't belong to them. It belonged to the kings, of the leaders, the rulers of their world. Western civilization changed all of that. And so we are the recipients, the blessed recipients of a way that we've been able to worship freely, learn about God, and also just, you know, God can unleash in us everything without restrictions from our government. Of course, we're coming into that now, but you know what I'm saying. We haven't had those restrictions until the last, 20, 25 years, something like that. Well, I just thought this conversation on The Golden Thread, A History of the Western Tradition, with Dr. James Hankins was terrific. And I'll be talking to him again in the future. You can bet I'll be doing that, plus his partner, who is a Lincoln historian, because very seldom now do you find these great men who are historians, who actually want to know the truth, don't want to rewrite it, don't want to tweak it, don't want to, you know, bend their will to the stories that they're reading. We have a lot of that going on, and I've had it with that, and that's not what we got from Professor Hankins. So I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. I want to remind you that Preborn is a sponsor. We could not do this without them, and I want to ask you in our final moments here if you would consider contributing to them a special gift for Christmas. Go to preborn.com/Sandy. That's preborn.com/Sandy, and make your most generous donation. Well, thank you for listening to this edition of Sandy Rios 24/7.